Blog Talk Radio.
From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Hello, is this David?
This is David.
Hi, David. Pete Peters here. We have finally made this connection. I do not know what was going on. I think we've already probably played our intro music.
Yes, you have.
So I'm going to just kind of continue as if nothing else has happened. How's that?
Wonderful.
We'll see how spurred the moment we can be. I just want to remind everybody that's listening, it is the Boomer and the Babe Show coming to you from the Feeding Arizona complex of the food bank here in Youngtown, Arizona. The Valley View Community Food Bank is where the food is always free. So anybody that's interested in making a donation of money or food can give them a contact via their website at valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com. And no donation is too small, and everyone will be greatly appreciated. This is the Boomer the Babe Show. I'm Pete Peters. Deborah the Babe is still on assignment. She's been on assignment a lot lately. I'm going to have to check out and see what she's doing between 10 and 11 every morning, Arizona time. But anyhow, we do much more than just this radio show. We are a multifaceted multimedia marketing company. We help you move your content, help you move your message via our radio show, via our e-books, our mini-books, video for your website, and we also do some promotional product work if you're in need of more identification for your company. So please keep us in mind when you need any of those. Now, our guest today is, in conjunction with what we do, also in the marketing field. He's written a book, quite an interesting book. I've been going through it and seeing a lot of things in there that I'm thinking, well, I didn't do that. And interesting ways of getting things done in a relatively inexpensive, in some cases, cost for small businesses. He himself runs a business in New York, the Big Apple, I guess it is. And our guest is David Langton. David, welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
Well, we're certainly glad to have you here after our travail this morning of trying to make the hookup. But tell us a little bit, if you don't mind, about what David Langton has done in the past and what brought you up to writing this book and being on the radio program with me today.
Well, I have been working with visuals my entire life as a communication designer and now teaching in college about digital communication. What I really wanted to do is to share some ideas about visual marketing with small business owners that they can put to work right away. And that's what we've done. We've come up with 99 case studies that make visuals come alive, because basically people underestimate the power of the visual. When they think of marketing, they often think of statistics, and they're not thinking of what does it look like and how does it really impact people. And most people actually use their eyes to take in what they see in the world.
So how has your background prepared you to do this, and what did you do prior to being involved in this aspect of your business?
Well, I've always been a visual communicator. Even when I go back to high school and before that, drawing cartoons and drawing images and thinking about things in a conceptual way, how do you bring visuals to the forefront? Because we find that most people actually learn through visuals, and you get bombarded by visuals. But as they say, you know, a visual's worth 1,000 words, but if they're not the right words, then maybe you need to take a look at what those visuals are.
Well, we're going to have an interesting time today trying to explain visuals on the radio. So I'm going to hold the book up in front of the microphone, and maybe people can see it through osmosis. I don't know. But at any rate, when you're looking to design a visual with one of your clients, what is one of the first things that you have to consider? Is it budget?
Well, that's certainly what clients like to think about first, but we like to think about how can you go forward without doing this? I mean, it's like walking down the street and not wearing any clothes. I mean, you've got to do some basics. And it's not just covering up. It's actually establishing a style, establishing an attitude, establishing a theme. All these things are part of establishing your visual outlook, and how people perceive you is initially what they see, whether it's on the website or if it's in a poster or if it's a logo or even just something like how you dress, and it's kind of goes along with your handshake. It's very important that you do it right.
I have completely agreement with what you say, and what we do and what Deborah does in particular is she is involved in helping people define and develop their brand. And a brand is everything that you have mentioned, whether it's the way you dress, the way you look, the way you talk, the way you shake hands. She says even to the point of the way you accept and give a business card has said something about your brand, because your brand is you. And I'm finding that what you're saying there is right in alignment with many of the things that we talk to small businesses about also. What part of the brand do you see the visual being, as far as does it create it, does it enhance it, does it promote it? What does the visual do as far as the brand is concerned?
Well, you always talk about how you can't make a second first impression. The visual is usually the first impression. So it's really all about what impression do you want to make with your prospects and with your clients and with your staff. Everybody has to really tie into that message, and that message is projected through your look and through your feel. We like to say that, you know, anybody can look good. That's easy. We can make you look good. But is it the right look for your brand? Does it really show what you're about, and does it meet the needs of your client? Because there's a distinction to be made between your personal brand and your person. And sometimes your brand has to be a little wackier or sometimes a little more serious, but you should have an understanding of what that brand is as opposed to just who you are when you walk down the street.
Mm-hmm. So the brand really, would you say the brand comes first in this particular instance and then you build to the brand?
I think so. I mean, we spend a lot of time, you know, combining images with messaging, because I think that's important as well. But we build the brand around what we call the functions and the meanings. So we talk about these three legs on the stool, which is the style, the function, and the meaning. So the style has to work with the function. What is the brand all about? And what does it mean? So you have to be careful when you are working with images, because people interpret them differently. So you have to look at them from how is your audience going to look at these images, and what does it say about me, and what does it say about how I address the needs of my audience? It's a lot different than just saying I'm going to get dressed to look nice in the morning.
Right. Now, I'm going to assume, and if it's not the case, we can go in a different direction, but I'm going to assume for the sake of this question that you probably watched the Super Bowl this weekend, seeing how you're in New York.
That's a fair assumption. We're all still feeling on top of the world over here in New York.
I would imagine so. But as a sidelight to that, but directly involved in what you do, did you watch the commercials?
Yes, I'm always guilty of being the one that watches the commercials even more than the game. And, you know, they spend an awful lot of money trying to attract your attention for 30 to 60 seconds.
Yes. Now, let's talk about some of the visuals that you saw on those commercials. Was there one that was more visually appealing to you than others?
Well, I would just say overall, I thought this year's commercials were very disappointing. I think maybe it's because there's so much money being spent, they all played it kind of safe. There wasn't anything that really stuck out that I was like, wow, that's great. I wish I had done that. There was a lot of things that I thought were good ideas that weren't executed well. And I, you know, my favorite in that camp was the Elton John Pepsi ad, which I thought was a very funny setup to have him kind of be like an American Idol judge, judging each person that comes up to sing, and then eventually falling into the dungeon himself when he gets blown away by that star who sings Respect. But I thought it was poorly executed. I thought that should have been a series of like 15-second spots sprinkled throughout the Super Bowl so that by the end you were like waiting to see what would happen next. I think it could have been funnier if they repeated it more, and I think they just kind of blew their 30 seconds in one shot and didn't get the mileage out of it they could have.
What did you think about that one that is causing so much furor, the Chrysler commercial with Clint Eastwood?
Yeah, well, I heard that was the a lot of people found that to be their favorite. It struck a chord with some people.
But I mean, as far as the commercial itself, do you think it was? I mean, I looked at it, and I'm from Detroit originally, so I looked at it with a little different. A different eye, I think, and I thought the commercial itself, looking at the commercial, was certainly interesting. I wasn't paying as much attention to the message as what apparently politicos were.
Well, you know, I think that's a good point, because what happens when people look at things is you don't realize, you know, all the meanings that go to images and to the visuals. And there's a case that was on NPR last night with a Chicago situation where I think they've built a symbol that they did a contest, and it's supposed to be supporting the fire department and the police department, and the symbol that won the contest apparently uses some subliminal gang imagery. So now there's this uproar of like, well, the shapes of the hands and the thing are similar to a signal that a gang in Chicago does. And so they had to pull the image. And the artist who did it was all in tears and said, well, I wasn't thinking about that. And the issue here is not whether or not the artist was thinking about it. The issue is if that provokes that type of response in your audience, then you have to change it. And we have to do that when we create visuals all the time. We have to make sure they're the right one. And it's not the right one because I like it and it looks good over my couch. How does it impact my audience? And that's a very controversial one, and I think the Clint Eastwood one as well. You need to know where you're going with this stuff. And sometimes you don't know until you do it. But then you have to adjust your images. When I'm teaching my class, I tell them that, you know, there's no such thing as a stupid audience. There are some stupid designers who want to blame their audience because their audience thinks of it differently than them. But it's about what the audience thinks. It's not about what you think. You're a commercial artist. You're not a fine artist. And you need to, you know, take ownership when an image is not working for you.
Yeah, and it's simply the case that it's that in the eye of the beholder thing, and that's truly the way it is in that respect, because you can do one thing and be offering what you think is one message, and it can be 180 degrees off.
Well, we kind of learn by putting it out there, and yeah. I think the bigger lesson for us as visual communicators and for small businesses who want to use visual is that they are very powerful, and we often underestimate. We use cheap pictures, and we stick things up, and we don't really think about what they mean, and we need to go back and say, well, what is the meaning of this image? Because the meaning of the image and how it connects to your messaging is critical to the success of the communication.
Let's talk about a small business using image. Let's talk about a mom and pop using visuals and how they can do it, or an independent business person. Where does the visual start? Does it start with their business card?
I still think the business card is a critical form of communication that people underestimate. I mean, when people give me a crummy business card, or frankly those quick print cards that you can get on the internet, I always think, oh, this is cheap. This is not a real business. They can't even invest in a decent business card. I think it says a lot about the seriousness of your communication. It's like getting a limp handshake if you don't have a good business card.
I agree with that. So what are some of the better business cards that you've seen? So that's probably going to be for some major companies, major manufacturers, whatever, that have stuck out in your mind that associate with a visual that is probably nationally known? What are some of the better uses of visuals?
Well, you know, I actually like to do it a different way. I like to have business cards that have some extra features in them. I think it's great if you can put QR codes on the back of your business card. Someone flips it over, and there's a scannable card there, and then people can scan it with their phones and go to your website and learn more about you. I think that's a really wonderful feature, and a lot of people are doing that. A lot of the financial services companies use the back of their business card to put either like something in Chinese or Japanese so that you could immediately see that this business card has a dual purpose, and they're, you know, they're an international company, so that's really nice. There's a business card that we feature for the HR lady, which is a wonderful small business person who distinguished herself in the market by calling herself the HR lady, and she helps companies with their human resources. And her business card has a great caricature of her with the letters HR plus and then her head. So it's HR plus lady. And then when you flip it over, it has all the information to contact her. But it's very distinguished, and it has separated her from the pack in her town. She is known as the HR lady, so everyone calls her when they have any issues with human resources, which all small business people seem to at some point.
Sure. It's interesting that you say on the back, because I don't recall until recent years that people have realized that there is a back to a business card that is usable space.
Absolutely. We like to say that's the billboard that for your company. You have an opportunity there to put some, it could be an expression, it could be a website, it could be a photo or an image. We did a wonderful series of business cards for a color printer in New York City a few years ago, and we just took images of beautiful photographs of flowers and birds and nature and printed them on the backs of their business cards, and we printed 6 different ones, so when the salespeople went out, they could shuffle them up and give everybody a different picture. And it made a different impression because they were all about visuals and about communicating the power of print. And here they had it on their card. So their card became more than a calling card, but actually an example of their work.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. What about the size of a business card? I mean, you've say, we've talked to people that say, well, the size should be square. It should be this. It should be that. Folded business cards, maybe a business card that folds halfway back down the back or something like that. Doesn't that cause problems at some level?
You know, it depends on your business. I think you can get away with that if you're a boutique and you want to show yourself as being different. I think it's nice to actually use the card, the standard size card, because people kind of collect them and hold them and they fit in your wallet. I mean, I think there's a reason that that size has kind of worked in the American market. I do have a lot of nice ones that are square. We have one that has little creases on the back, and it can turn into an easel because it's done by a painter, and he wants to show that his business card actually becomes an easel that holds a little mini painting. That's a very clever one. There's some that are like three-dimensional, and in certain markets, I think that might be a distinguishing characteristic. But you have to make sure that it's taken seriously. You don't want to be frivolous, and you don't want to look like you spent $1 million on your business card. What you want to look like is that you take yourself and your services seriously and that your business card is branded consistently. So if I look at your business card and then I go to your website, there's some relationship there, whether it's the logo, the color, the artwork. We see consistency in the way that you market yourself.
Yeah, you don't want to out-cute yourself on your business card.
I mean, yeah, we don't want to, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, you absolutely don't.
Just look at me, how cute I am. I got a cute business card, and then the rest of it falls off the table. There's nothing there. There's no substance there. It could certainly damage your brand by doing that as well as other things.
You can. I always think it's interesting that certain industries, and for some reason it's real estate, they like to put their photos on their business cards. I always thought that that would be like the beauty salon companies would do that, but they don't. They never do. You always find them on real estate people.
Well, that is true, as a matter of fact. Well, let's talk about here's something that's just popped into my head when you start talking about photos. Deborah and I were talking about, I don't know if you've had occasion to go to our website, but our picture's all over that doggone thing. Sometimes I wonder why we did that too, but we at one point were considering doing a wrap for our one of our automobiles and having the boomer and the babe all over it, you know, and having our pictures on the car. What do you think of that kind of stuff?
To wrap the car, you mean the visual wraps all the way around and you have the images everywhere?
Yes.
I don't know that I would do it for you, maybe for the babe.
You've seen my website.
But I do think that that can be a really effective, like if you're the local flower shop, and I've seen those, you know, the delivery truck gets wrapped. We have seen many occasions where we have, you know, really told our clients, like, if you have a unique car or truck that is essentially a billboard for your company and you do deliveries and or you drive around town, you drive in New York City, you have a, you know, an opportunity, again, another billboard opportunity to be visual. And it should relate back to your theme and your message and your website. Everything should relate. So it shouldn't be some little odd thing that you have that's on the wrap around the car and then you can't find it anywhere else. It should connect to your marketing plan.
Let me ask you this. As far as visuals are concerned now, is a website probably the central location for most people, or should be the central location for most people's visuals?
I think it should be the center of your universe in terms of your marketing. For most businesses, the website is where people get credibility. You know, some businesses sell a lot online. My business doesn't sell anything online, but what it does is it gives my prospects and clients credibility. They come to my website, they see projects that we've done, and they go, "Oh, this company's handled a lot of this great work, and this is who I want." It's a credibility booster. It's really important. We work with a lot of industries in financial services and some of the legal profession where most of the sale, I would say 90% of it, is the relationship. But even with those situations, you tend to Google the person afterwards and go look at their LinkedIn account, look in their Facebook page, look at their website, and you make sure that all those areas are consistent in their messaging and in their visuals. And that's really important because that's the credibility. People expect that of you. If they go and they can't find you, or they go to your website and they see something that your cousin put up for you, it does not say what you're all about. It's like that wimpy handshake again.
Mm-hmm. So I've heard people say that you need to have something for sale on your website. That this, you know, what am I selling on my website? What are you selling on your website? Where do you come down with regard to actually having products for sale on your site?
Well, again, I think if you're in professional services, what I've been telling people is it shouldn't be for sale. It should be for free. I mean, you might want to give something away or give somebody a teaser or something that talks about what you do. It's not always appropriate to have something for sale. And we have links to things, like you can buy the book, but you don't actually buy it on the website. You buy it at Amazon.
Okay.
You know, I don't think the website has to be a sale vehicle as much as it needs to be a marketing vehicle, depending on your business. Some places you really need to make contact with somebody, and the real talk is what you want. You want to be able to get a phone call going or a meeting, and so it's a lead generator more than a sales. It depends. If you're selling goods, then by all means, that website should be easy to buy, and that's a whole other, you know, thing that the website needs to do.
Well, then it becomes a shopping cart and so on and so forth, and you have to be able to take credit cards and on a secure site. And that's a different package, I think, completely.
Right, but I mean, that's easy to do these days. But I think for what we really are advocating is that regardless, all these websites need to be visual, and they need to have a consistent theme, and the messaging really needs to be strong. It has to say something about what you do. And if you do sell a lot of widgets, then by all means, put in the shopping cart. That's not a huge expense. You'll pay for itself in no time if you're doing that. But if you're selling professional services, not necessarily. You might want to have them come to your store, or you might want to have them come and meet with you, or you meet with them. But in any case, it should talk about you, and it should look great.
Mm-hmm. Because it is, after all, visual.
Right. Most people I talk to, they're embarrassed by their website. "Oh, I did that years ago. It looks terrible. I don't like the pictures." I said, well, you know, it's time to change that. You shouldn't be embarrassed by your website. Your website shouldn't be holding you back. It should be putting you out there in a good light. It's your opportunity to control the messaging. So many times you can't control it. Other people say things and do things about you. But on your website, you can control it. You can project great imagery. And we've seen it work for people. We've seen people turn their businesses around by presenting themselves in a professional manner on their website, and then that leads to sales.
I agree with that. I sometimes am more in tune with the people that say just make it a marketing piece with regard to promoting your own goods and services, and then, like you say, the link goes elsewhere for make your purchase here or whatever that might be.
Well, it's reminding me one of our best website designs is for Renaissance Capital, which is an IPO firm in Greenwich, Connecticut. And they get quoted constantly in the Wall Street Journal, particularly with Facebook and its IPO rolling out. They're always on the air as the expert in IPOs. They didn't have a very strong website a few years ago, and after we worked with them, we reformatted their website. They were getting 1 million hits a month, which is great traffic, but they weren't really selling anything. They actually were giving away a lot of free information about IPOs, and that's actually what gave them the credibility that the Wall Street Journal would want to quote them. However, they needed to monetize it. They were selling subscription services, and they had mutual funds, and they had benchmarking features that they were not selling until they had a website that actually turned everything around. Now when you go to their website, it's organized, and it visually drives you through. You can see the subscriber section. You can see the benchmarking. You can see how to get into the mutual fund. And, oh, by the way, there's a lot of free things here. And what they've been able to do now is they actually sell off the website. People come in, they see what they like, and then they go, oh, I think I need this subscription service. And those are amazing things. Now this company is really getting its bang out of the website. And a lot of it is because they are professionally positioned and they really embraced visual marketing.
When they're selling something off the website, Is that another page on their website? Is it like a product section? How do they do that?
Well, for them, I mean, they have a book that they sell, but what they're really selling is an opportunity to talk to their sales staff.
I see.
So you click in, and then you see, and there's like a sales page that tells you, this is what you get if you subscribe here. These are the types of features, and you get depth, and you get, you know, real-time news, and you get a much more sophisticated, allotment of fees and services. But you can then contact the right people to get that service. Before, people would just go in and they'd grab a quote and say, oh, this is an interesting, little five-second analysis of what's going on at Facebook. But if you really want to know what's going on, they've got, a 30-page analysis that will take you a lot deeper. And a lot of it was trying to find the right audience to get to the right place. Some people don't want that depth, and others do. So the website helps drive you and separates you. It's a segmentation process of coming into the website, and the best websites do this. They have this process called progressive disclosure, where you progress in on the way that you want to go, and the website is designed to drive you towards either a subscription base or towards the free or towards the information that's appropriate for you. Good websites are doing that. They're offering, multi-tracks, and it allows the user of the website to see where they want to go and the owner of the website to track the people that are, going to be best for them.
What about using your website to obtain a mailing list? So how do you go about doing that? I mean, because I know for a fact that there are a lot of small business people that we deal with on a regular basis that they're trying to get the email addresses of people and trying to do it properly. I mean, they're not just going to sit there and start inputting business cards. They're going to give them double opt-ins and things like that because that's something that we certainly recommend that they do so people aren't being spammed. But what do you suggest about how to try to build a mailing list via your website?
Well,
I think it's very important.
And it's very important, and it's actually really easy to do. You want to have a plugin that collects email addresses. So when people come into the website, you offer them an opportunity to join your website, and you could offer them a free book. I've seen a lot of e-books and a lot of excerpts and things sign up here, and you get the free excerpt. And in doing so, you have an option to join our weekly or monthly e-blast. You can plug into Constant Contact, My Emma. We use Google actually it's a plug-in onto your website. So when people type in their email, it automatically goes into the system, and it screens out the spam, and it also allows them to opt out anytime, so that you're not, you know, spamming back people. It's permission marketing. You're asking for permission, and you're collecting people who are interested in the things that you have to offer. I think the important thing is to make sure that you offer them information that they want, not just feed them sales materials. You don't want to just give away sales tips and points, because people don't really care about that. They want, what can this do for me? So can we give you content that you're interested in? That's what we do. We offer people free content on certain topics each month. This is stuff that you might be interested in that helps you visually build your business. And if you'd like to hear more about this, subscribe. We'll send it to you once a month. And that's what leads to a good relationship, because we're not just touting, like, you know, awards or just tooting our own horn. We're actually offering services. We spend time writing and developing content with visuals that we give to all of our customers and prospects.
That I'm real pleased to hear you say that, and let me explain why. We just recently put up our inaugural issue of our online magazine Experience, actually Boomer Experience Speaks, on our website, and it is free. And we ask people to sign up for that. And the information that's in the magazine, there are some ads in there. There's some self-promotion in there. But more importantly than that, many of the people, if not all, of the people that have contributed to the magazine are people that have been on our show. And they have contributed a 700, 750-word article about their area of expertise. We in turn then make sure that their website is available, and we also put a live link back to their show on Blog Talk, so if somebody wants to listen to it, if they haven't heard it before, they can go and do so. And the response that we've gotten to that after the very first one has been very, very good, because everything that's in there is relatable to a baby boomer, and that's what it's designed for, of course. I mean, we have somebody that's written an article about things that you have to consider, and she has her own business about helping people settle estates after the final affair. And we got somebody else in there that is a real estate investor, and people are looking at real estate as possible investments, and he will help. He has information about that. These are articles about these various topics, and they are they're well versed as far as the types of articles they are in topics. And I think that's going to be of a great value to people, because we have a real mix of people on this radio show. And they all have a lot of good information. And that leads me to my next question. I would like you to write something for us as well.
Okay, well, that's not a problem. I mean, I think that's what we do. We practice what we preach. I mean, it's very important that you don't just reposition things and basically just do hard sell all the time. We really try to add value, and you try to bring in content that really helps people build their businesses, whether it's helping them to understand what a logo is all about, or how to create one, or how to evaluate whether it's time to get a new one, or whether it's just, here's some visual things that you can do to boost your business. And that's really why we wrote this book. We really took 99 examples of how can you put this into practice in your business today. There's examples of using websites online. There's examples of using print and poster and business card design and things that are, you know, printed. And then there's things that you can do for yourself in terms of live and experiential graphics that are really important. And if you could tie all these three areas together, online, in print, and in, you know, life, you really have the makings of a strong marketing program.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the book, because after all, we do want to make sure that people understand what you've done here. It's written by David Langton and Anita Campbell. Who is Anita Campbell? Is she a...
Anita Campbell is a small business expert, and we came together to write this book. She writes it from the perspective of marketing and small business expertise, and I bring the visual acumen and the marketing of a designer to the project.
Well, I was in looking through the book. I mean, it's just all kinds of great information in there, and I appreciate your sending me this. 99 Proven Ways for Small Businesses to Market with Images and Design. The nicest thing I like about the book, other than the fact that there's some great ideas, is on every item. For instance, number 57, waking up your brand with a little pillow talk, creating a follow-up campaign that makes prospects laugh and buy. And you go through that, you say why it works and so on and so forth. But then in the bottom right-hand corner of the right-hand page, you've got something, takeaway tip. And every one of these has a takeaway tip. And I think that's just invaluable.
Well, thank you, because this gives you an opportunity in every case study to do something for yourself. And that's really what this is about. How can we put this book to work? And so we spent a lot of time not only looking for things that were visual. We had three criteria. It had to be visual, it had to be effective and have a success metric, and it had to have a takeaway. It had to have something that you could learn from, or you could basically start to think about how you could market yourself using this idea. Most of these ideas are done by other small businesses, so it's easy to relate to them. Some of them are a little aspirational, and some of them are just real easy do-it-yourself tips.
Well, I tell you, it's really invaluable as far as I'm concerned, because I look at that, and there's many times that I've read something and I say, and what am I going to do with this? But I like the fact that it's brief. It allows you to get to the point very quickly, and it gives you something, as it says, to take away, and not many things do that. And there's a takeaway on everything from digital communications on signs on the road to what is this here? Just back here, it looks like it's a frozen yogurt cup. it's very, very, very nicely done. Did you design this book yourself?
Yes, I did. I designed it along with my colleagues Norman Cherubino and Jim Keller, who work with me here at the Langton Cherubino Group. And there's also an interesting thing, since you're in a hunger bank as your location, there is a case study on a hunger bank from Rhode Island that has a very clever visual campaign where they decided to sell nothing. And so it's the Nothing campaign, and they basically made cans of nothing, and they brought them around to supermarkets, and visually you have a can that you buy, and you can open it up, there's nothing in it, and that was the whole point. It's like, this is what happens when you're hungry, your can is empty. What happened with this campaign was they built up a lot of excitement about buying these cans, and then people actually started collecting money in the empty cans and returned them back to the hunger organization. So they won on two points. First, they did all this initial outreach. People bought the cans for $2.99, and they raised tens of thousands of dollars. And then people started sending cans of money back to the organization. So it really became this phenomenal growth for them, and it really came from a very simple visual idea.
What number was that? I missed that one.
That's number 65.
65. I'll write, there it is. Okay, excellent. I'll have to show this to Jesse Ramirez, who's a director of the and founder of the food bank. Another thing, just and maybe you can tell me what you think of this. This is something that Deborah came up with. We were trying to enter a program, help them enter a program with regard to picking up people can make donations of food, and they had some boxes, food boxes, donation boxes that they would put outside grocery stores and whatever, with permission. And but we need signage for that. And so Deborah came up with something called Toucan Tilly, Tilly the Toucan. And the theory being, whenever you're in the grocery store, buy two cans for Tilly. Tilly is a toucan, but the body of Tilly is a can of beans, I think, and a can of corn. I don't recall now exactly. It's a very colorful little caricature, and she put it together, and we made posters. Pick up two cans for Tilly. And Toucan Tilly has really kind of become very noticeable and can be identifiable to this food bank in a small way in this area, which is really nice to see. And it's something that you've got to try to do. And I like this can here, because we could almost include something about two cans with those cans as well.
Absolutely. It's a very clever idea. And in both cases, both of these campaigns, what they do is they take an issue like hunger that we often think is insurmountable. We look at this and we go, you know what, this is terrible. It even says in the Bible, they will always be with you. And how do you come to terms with the fact that hunger will always be with you? It's so overwhelming that sometimes we just shut it out and think we can't combat hunger. And yet, here we are looking at ending hunger with campaigns that bring it down to the personal level. Can you bring it down to two cans? Can you bring it down to one empty can of nothing? Well, I could do that. Yeah, I can chip in $2.99, or I could buy an extra can. These are things that I can do. And when you start to see that you can do these things, the impact and how it gets multiplied out, it's greater and greater and greater. And, you know, so I think these are wonderful campaigns, and these are things that are also great examples of how you can put visual marketing to work.
Yes, it works very, very well for us, for this food bank, and those posters are it's a very colorful, enjoyable to look at, and it gets the message across real quick. People understand. And there's probably some people that maybe didn't see it on the way in and saw it on the way out, and they went back in and got two cans and put it in the box. So that's what it's all about. That's what we're trying to do. The book itself, 99 Proven Ways, how did you assemble these 99 ways? Are these all projects that you folks have done?
I think there are about six projects in the book that we have done ourselves, and that was the genesis of the idea, is that we started looking at what we were doing, and then we said, you know, there's a lot of creative people across the country, so we spent a lot of time doing research and trying to get different projects from every state or every corner of the country, and we basically solicited ideas and concepts from people from all over the country. We also have half a dozen projects from Europe and Canada and South America, so that we have a little bit of international flavor in there as well. And again, we had our criteria of making sure, number one, it's visual, number two, it's effective, number three, that it has a takeaway tip. So we did a lot of evaluation on, you know, as I'm always saying, not just to look good, but to work. So it had to have the function and the meaning tied together with the style.
So what should a person, when they have their hands on this book, what should they do with the book? I mean, how should they use the book functionally?
I think it's a great book to actually get very dog-eared with lots of post-it notes and I like to photocopy pages out of it in times, because there's certain ideas in here that you can just put to work right away. You can go through it and look at it from what kind of a business am I? Well, let me see if I can find a business like mine, see what they're doing. Or you can look at it as like, these are things that I could do to make my business stand out, and I can make it stand out online or in print or in person by using the tips that are in here. So it's a resource guide. You can flip through it and pick out something and say, oh, I could adapt this and do something like this. Or this makes me think of an idea that's similar that would be appropriate for my company. And I think we see it as an idea generator. We find that I got very excited working on the book because I started to see that there are all these great visual ideas happening across the country. And some of us, even though we are the land of the giants and the winners of the Super Bowl, if I haven't mentioned that before, we in New York sometimes think that we are on top of the world, but we found it a little bit humbling to see that there's actually great work going on all around the country.
There's a lot of people that are very pleased that the Giants won, but Giselle is not one of them. let me ask you another thing here about this book. Are there a couple of things in this book that are your favorite? I mean, you've been working hard on it for as long as you did. Is there one or two, maybe three or four favorites?
One of my favorites is for the Lorden Climate, Home Climate Company, which you probably don't have this problem in Arizona, but up here sometimes it gets a little cold. And this is essentially an old-fashioned oil company that rebranded themselves as the Home Climate Company. And one of the things that they did is they gave away funny colored bright fuzzy socks to anybody they gave three pairs of socks to anybody who wanted to try out their service. And it became a phenomenon. They're so colorful. They took these socks and they photographed them and they wrapped them around the oil tanker trucks, and they put them in their flyers and in their advertising, and they stuck them under people's doors. And suddenly people were starting to wear these socks because they were fun and colorful, and it tied right back to their brand. It was all about keeping warm at home. What better way to keep warm at home? Well, have a very reliable oil company and wear a nice pair of these fuzzy socks. It's a really wonderful tie-in with their messaging, and it became more of reinforcing the fact that they were a family company and they'd been around for generations, that they're competing with some other generic company where people just look at the price of the oil. And now they are like the personal company, the company that takes care of you, that comforts you when it's cold. And I loved that one. It was just a really fun one to write, and it was very exciting to talk to the designers and the owners of the company that are making this work.
Where do these ideas come from? I mean, I for the most part, am somewhat creative. I'm not a creative genius by any stretch, but these things will come to me, and that's just what happens. They just kind of come to me. Do people actually sit down and think and try to think creatively? How do you guys do
it? We do it every single day, and I'll tell you, sometimes it can be very tiring, and sometimes it's one of those things that the old cliche in the shower where things just kind of all come together when you're thinking about something else. We do a process that we call work together, work apart, where we get together in our room and in our conference room, and we sit around and we put lots of pictures up on the wall, and we throw a slide projector on and look at websites, and we start thinking about how, what kind of visuals, what are the themes, what is this company about, who are their competitors. We do some research, and we talk about the criteria of the project, and that's the work together part. Then we go off to our own little corners, and for a few days we just kind of do sketching and dreaming and do our own research and try to come back. And it's a bit of a challenge. Then we all take our sketches and go back in that room again. And sometimes we argue with each other, and sometimes we get inspired, and sometimes we, you know, get annoyed. But it's part of that combustion of getting together again and seeing how do these ideas work. And this is kind of a back and forth. Then we go back to our spaces and we evaluate again, and then we come back. And we'll do this like 4 or 5 times before the client even sees anything. This is a process that has been working for us for like 15 years. And, you know, part of it is that we are all visual thinkers, and some of us are more analytical, and some of us are more dreamers, but the combination is what makes the creative juices flow.
How often, or does it happen that you're in your in your conference room and you're looking at a particular project, and somebody comes up with something that's a very serious way of looking at it, and other somebody comes up and it's a little lighthearted, and some of them come up and it's just absolutely off the wall? I mean, do you ever have that when there's 3 or 4?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, were you here yesterday? Because that's what happened here, you know? It happens a lot. Partially it's because we all have very different personalities, and we bring different things to each topic, and some of us are passionate about certain things in a certain way that are different. What I think I found when I was doing the research on this book is I was just so impressed by how people across the country have been thinking about a lot of things that you might think are the same old thing, but they came up with a very clever solution. And I found that sometimes you need to be, you know, rejuvenated by looking at what other people have done. So the other thing is this book inspires ideas, but it also inspires just the whole concept of inspiration. You see how people think about of concepts, and that, you know, that leads you to think about things differently. Sometimes you have to take it all apart. Sometimes that dreamer, if you have the most ridiculous idea, is the one who's on to something. Or it's the step that leads you to something else. And that's like we always say, I know there's that cliche, there's no bad ideas. We say, you know, there's a lot of bad ideas. Well, let's put them up on the wall anyway. Because some of those bad ideas lead to a good one, and that's where we're going.
Yeah, there are bad ideas. I'm glad to hear somebody finally say that, because there really are some bad ideas sometimes. Now, how do you come to that consensus? If you've got four people, whatever it might be in the room, and they're all divergent views on how you should visually promote this product or what the message should be. How do you come to the consensus? Is it an arm wrestling match? Is it, do you duel to the death? What do you do?
Well, it can be. I mean, I think that we also have a lot of respect for each other. So even though we don't always agree, We actually have a lot of respect for the process. And sometimes we just let it sit for a while. And ultimately, it seems that the best ideas do bubble to the top. We will sometimes come in with a range of ideas, and we love to invite the clients in. We have this process that we call inviting the clients into the sketching process, where we will actually take very divergent ideas and categorize them and put words up on the wall that talk about their mission in different ways. And we'll say, you know, this is kind of a silly idea, but we want to show it to you anyway because it says something about your company and your business and your service that you might want to share with some other people. And sometimes that becomes the one that we end up refining and going with. Sometimes it's one that we discard, but it was important to share it with the clients so they could see that we were thinking about their company in a different way. And each concept kind of shows a different lens on what the company could be and what the image could be. That's why we think it's really important that you really evaluate your imagery and your visuals, that it's not just something where I picked a picture and I stuck it up on the wall and that's it. Or I got a good deal on it because it was free photo. It's like it has to be the right photo for the right company for the right message. And we spend a lot of time doing that evaluation. The client comes in on that because it's ultimately up to them to get, you know, to put on this nice suit that we're making for them. It has to fit. And they have to feel comfortable in it. It can be what we can tell them they should wear a certain thing, but you know, not everyone's gonna like look like Elton John with high heels. It's not right for everyone. So even though we might think that's cool, if the client doesn't think it's not a fit, then there's something off. And we use the client as the gauge to really ultimately tell us what is the final one. We will tell them, like, these are all these options, but it's up to the client to be part of that process.
Well, there's a couple of things that you just said in that explanation that ring true with me. And I, first of all, I'm glad to hear that you have your client at some point somewhat involved in seeing what their possibilities are, because I think that would help the client immensely to be able to say, to kind of pick and choose, maybe let's combine these two or whatever the case might be, rather than you just walking in and saying, here, this is what we want, slap it on the wall and say, this is the one to go with. Because you've given yourself a better opportunity to serve that client on a continuing basis and not be dismissed by that client. Because how many times does it happen that there are two or three competing agencies, they each come in with their plan for that client, and the client discards two of them because they have no other options other than those two or those three, and they take the one that they like best or maybe the one that they dislike least. Maybe that's the way to put it, and they go with it. And
right,
and
I think if the client is involved in the process, that doesn't happen as often. I mean, you really want their buy-in.
That's right. I agree. I'm just agreeing with you there.
The great designer Milton Glaser had a piece recently where he said that he called it "Don't Just Do It." And it was really kind of a front to the Nike logo, the Just Do It Nike logo, which you know everybody loves, and that little logo with the little hook at the bottom. He said everybody thinks that that every logo is like the Nike logo, that you can create a little tiny symbol like that that will take off and make a $1 billion brand out of a pair of sneakers. He said, you know, it just short sells the whole process. And Nike doesn't actually make their money off the fact that they have a little inverted comma as their logo. They make their money off the fact that they spend, you know, billions of dollars messaging with images and endorsements and creating a brand that's way beyond the scope of that little mark. But people think, oh, if Nike can have like a little inverted comma as their logo, then I can too, and I can build my small business around that. And we tell them, you know, you don't have the marketing muscle of a Nike, but you need to have a logo that really reflects your company and your service and your business. And it's the logo, it's the imagery, it's the attitude, it's everything around it that matters.
Well, I'm just going to go back to the home office, the office at home, and I'm going to say to Deborah, Deb, here's the deal. Nike has their comma. You and I are going to have a semicolon. We'll go from there. The other thing that I wanted to mention to you when you were talking about the message and getting the message out properly and so on and so forth, and it reminded me of what we tell people that we try to do for them, and that is we help them find their MVP, the right message with the right vehicle to the right people. And that's what we try to do as part of our objective when we're trying to help them move their content, whether it be with a video, with a radio show, with an advertisement on the radio show, a guest appearance, whatever it might be. But we try to help them find their MVP. And some things just aren't right for all people. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think that process is actually, you know, we have our own form of that, but that is the basis for how you determine whether you have the right visual for your company, business, or service. And that's what you should be doing. Find out what motivates you and where do you want to be and how you reflect yourself to the right audience.
And you have to be able to identify your audience, and you need to know who your audience is, and you have to identify them, because there's no sense, if you're going to be marketing to baby boomers, you can't be having your message to the 18 to 25 group. It just won't fly.
No, well, you really need to know who your audience is, and we always challenge people on that, because people constantly tell us, the whole world is my audience, and I say, no, not really. So let's really narrow it down a little bit, and let's make sure your messaging meets your audience.
Yeah, for instance, what we're trying to do is we're trying to do certainly baby boomers, and baby boomers possibly going into business or reinventing themselves because of the situation they have economically right now. And if anybody else comes along and hears the message, hey, great, more power to them. They might be able to find something from that. But we're really we're directing it hopefully towards the baby boomer market, because so many of them have been in industry or business for such a long period of time, and they've been just, you know, going to work, having their thing at their bench or wherever they are, doing their business, having their lunch and coming home over and over and over again for maybe 25, 30 years, and all of a sudden they're finding themselves in a different place. And those are the people that we think we can help if they want to go into business. If they don't want to go into business or if they're thinking of other things that are confronting them now, we hopefully can help them find some solutions. That's not to say that what we're saying isn't good for everybody, but we don't go around saying, okay, Mr. 18, 19-year-old, come and listen to me, because chances are they're not listening to their parents. They're not going to listen to their grandparents.
Well, that's a good point. And I think, you know, we say everybody should be more visual, which is true. But when you're selling a particular product to a particular audience, you can make sure that that visual is appropriate for that audience.
Right.
And so, you know, there's lots of wonderful things that appeal to baby boomers, and that's, if that's the marketplace, that's what your imagery should do. It shouldn't be looking like so cutting edge that it's really for the millennium crowd, because that's a different audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see by the clock on the wall, the hands on the clock on the wall, that we're coming down to the short rows here, and I tell you, it's been absolutely amazing and a lot of fun talking to you, David. It's been all good information. Are there one or two things that you'd like to leave me and our audience with as far as the book, where they can get hold of it? How can they get hold of you if they have more questions? Whatever information you'd like. This is your commercial now.
Well, thank you. The book is Visual Marketing, and it's available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble online. You can go to visualmarketingbook.com and find out more information about Anita and me and learn more about visual marketing in the process.
Well, that's great, and continued good success. We didn't even get into the topic of what it's like to actually be working in New York, but I'm sure we'll maybe have another chance to do that.
Certainly do a follow-up, but as I said, we're on top of the world right now, and we'll try not to rub that in your nose. But
Well, you know, you never can tell when the Arizona Cardinals are going to make another appearance in the Super Bowl, but they're going to have to go through New York to get there.
Okay.
David, thanks again. I'll be getting in touch with you with regard to making a contribution to our magazine, which we would greatly appreciate, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Boomer the Babe Show here on Blog Talk Radio. And this is our standard bill of fare every day, Monday through Friday from 10 to 11. We try to bring you good conversation, bring good conversation to the world, and today we brought excellent conversation with Mr. David Langton, who is the co-author of a book called Visual Marketing. So make sure you take a look at Visual Marketing, and it maybe help you get your small business underway and maybe define some of the information that you need with regard to your marketing needs and how to go about doing it. Examples, Rain, just all kinds of them in there, 99 different examples ranging in various prices and various amounts of complexity and so on. So this is the Boom and the Babe Show. We're signing off right now for the day. You can listen to us, as I said, every Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock right here on Blog Talk. Remember, we do much more than this radio show. Go to boomandthebabe.com for all the information about the Boomer and the Babe and what we do. Also, sign up, please, for our Boomer magazine. And we're going to be doing a lot more of these shows next week with a lot more different guests. And hope you have a wonderful weekend, everybody. My tongue is in front of my eye teeth. I can't see what I'm saying, and I don't know why. We'll talk to you later. Have a great weekend, everybody. Take care. To the Boom and the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.